change subjects with you. You have joined a chorus of Democrats who have accused this president and this administration of basically misleading, some say even lying the country into this war. And I want to ask you about one specific case, if I can. You've charged repeatedly that the president said before the war that you couldn't distinguish between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Aren't you distorting what the president actually said?
No, that's exactly what his words were.
That you couldn't distinguish.
That's exactly right.
Well, let's take a look at what the president actually said in September of 2002. Here it is.
Both of them need to be dealt with. The war on terror, is you can't distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Saddam when you talk about the war on terror. I can't distinguish between the two because they're both equally as bad.
The point, Senator, is he wasn't saying that Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda were linked. He was specifically asked which one is more dangerous, and he was saying he couldn't distinguish and say one was more dangerous than the other.
Yeah, but what he also said in the same sentence was that Saddam Hussein would like nothing more than to use a terrorist network to attack and to kill. And that is not what the intelligence was, which said that Saddam Hussein was, quote, intensely secular, wary of Islamic revolutionary movements. That's what the intelligence was. But, and yet the president tried to link those two, and he did. The majority of the American people believed when we went to war that Saddam Hussein had attacked us on 9/11 and on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln immediately following the war when he said mission accomplished. The president of the United States said, we have removed an ally of Al-Qaeda. Those were exactly his words. They were not allies.
Senator, he was specifically... If I can ask a question here, he was specifically was asked at one point if there was any evidence that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, and he said, no, there wasn't. And again, because, you know, we can go into all of these things, but that specific quote there, where you say he couldn't distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, he wasn't saying that they were linked at all. He was saying one was as bad as the other. And what he said in that same...
Wallace from Fox News. Not even Democrat lowlifes like Senator Levin are falling for your little cut and paste trick. You want to talk about one specific, take one specific case about Boy George linking Saddam to Al-Qaeda, ignore all the rest, and then cut and paste the particular one you want to talk about. This is sickening. When Boy George said, quote, the regime has long-standing and continuing ties to terrorist organizations and there are Al-Qaeda terrorists inside Iraq. The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb and with fissile material. Could build one within a year. Boy said that September 26, 2002. Why didn't you use that? Because you couldn't cut and paste it properly? You couldn't even cut and paste the other one that you used properly. Everyone's hip to your little tricks, even rat Democrats. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check it. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 freakradio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz, 107.5 North Carolina, 104.1 Berkeley, LUVER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe. And check out the Slave Web. Just Google in Slave Revolt Radio, the archive section and the blog. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to explore a slave insurrection attempt in 1776. 61. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Condition. Take a good look at this specimen, ladies and gentlemen. This has to be the buy of the afternoon. Early prime. Perfect physical condition. Under observation, he appeared so familiar, obedient, docile, and intelligent.
Conditioning was not considered necessary, but it certainly can be provided on request.
We're going to start the bidding on this specimen at $800. All right, now, ladies and gentlemen, what am I bid on this superb specimen? Bidding starts at $800. What am I bid for this superb specimen? $800.
$850
over here. Do I hear nine? And $850 over here. Do I hear nine?
$900.
I hear nine over there. Nine over there. Nine over there.
$950.
$950 over there on the end. $950 on the end. $1,000 from the gentleman on the end. $1,000 over here. $1,000.
$1,100.
$1,100 over here.
$1,150
in the back row.
$1,200.
$1,200 from this gentleman going to this gentleman. Going.
Buy him.
$1,500.
$1,500 from Mr. McDonald for His Excellency Governor Brett. Going, gone.
How do you propose to gain this freedom?
By the only means left to us. Revolution.
It's doomed to failure.
Perhaps. This time.
And the next.
Maybe.
But you'll keep trying.
You, above everyone else, should understand. We cannot be free until we have power. How else can we achieve it?
Brother Clarence Maxwell, who will lead in this discussion, in this blood slave segment titled The Poison and the Blade of 1761. So first let's check out from Clarence the players involved.
On September 12, 1761, a free black woman by the name of Rachel Fowler submitted a petition to the governor's council. She had been freed by her former owner, a woman by the name of Elizabeth Burgess, and the deed was clearly certified by the governor of the times, William Popple, in July 1759. But a fellow by the name of Captain Edward Seymour drew the conclusion that she was not to be freed, and he completely ignored it. He proceeded to kidnap her two children, Johnny and Lily, in lieu of her return to his service. And she writes, "Wherefore your petitioner humbly prays your excellency and honors take into the consideration and redress her in the manner that shall seem meet with your honest and with your excellency and honest by preventing Mr. Edward Seymour carrying into execution such his illegal and unwarrantable and vile practices and depriving his majesty's subjects of that most valuable valuable blessing on earth, her liberty. Oh, Governor Pop was obviously moved by those words. He proceeded to have Seymour ask Seymour to come to his house and to explain himself, and in the interim, he was ordered not to interfere with Pablo. But an event that occurs 1 month later, on October 12, 1761, will change everything. And that event occurs when another individual by the name of John Vickers is taking an evening stroll, and he overhears a conversation around 8 p.m., and he overhears a conversation with a group of blacks outlining an impending island-wide. It was about 6 to 8 men, and he hears the following conversation. One was from a fellow named Nat, a property of Thomas Cox, who said, "Nat, I possess a cow, and quote, no white body shall have any of it." He then uttered an imprecation against all whites and declared that he hoped to have a frolic in it, and that would be his wife's and his part in it. He never explained what it was. Another boy said he would threaten the first white body that took anything from him. They should kill him or he would kill them. Another voice comes rising out of the night, saying, "Indeed, there will be a great victory won here soon. Or if not, one half or two-thirds of all the Negroes in Bermuda will be hanged." Well, Vickers, of course, thought that was not evil to hear, and proceeds to remember that something he heard earlier that day by a Smith Parish pilot by the name of Peter, who said that if any white body should take anything from him, he would know the reason for it and be avenged. He identified another final voice as a man named by the name of George, another person from Smith Parish. He then proceeds on October 15th to report the incident.
So you can see what's taking place with some of the characters. Rachel Fobler, a free black person who had indeed a certificate of her freedom dating from 1759, has two of her kids kidnapped by a flesh peddler named Edward Seymour. He ignores, the the deeds and everything else because, these laws and other things mean nothing to the flesh peddlers of the world, whether they're Halliburton or, some flesh peddler in the Sudan or wherever, which is why the slaves owe the slavers nothing. The slaves owe the societies where we are living nothing. We owe their gods nothing except the blade, the fire, and the poison. That's all we owe them. But John Vicker, unfortunately, hears a conversation on October 12th by some other slaves planning a revolt. And hearing this conspiracy, which it was, he runs back and tells the governor, Popple, about this oncoming and what appears to be escalating conspiracy event. Now, when slaves are conspiring, this means that slaves have their heads on right, because the whole world is transfixed with conspiracies. Never let anyone try to confuse you or satirize you as being a conspiracy theorist. Of course, a slave that's not a conspiracy theorist is a slave that's a fool. We didn't get here by accident. Black people didn't end up in America by accident. White people didn't end up in Brazil by a coincidence. They didn't swim there. More than half of the population in Brazil is black. That wasn't by a coincidence. It was by conspirators. Things just didn't happen. Haiti's not filled up with black people. The Dominican Republic, Jamaica, the Caribbean Islands, Cuba, Venezuela, North America. It just didn't happen. People conspired to trade our flesh throughout the New World for other goods, for their own means and enrichment. Just like the flesh peddlers that peddled us off into what's modern day Baghdad, you know, the Zanj, through that episode of the Arab-Islamic slave trade. That didn't just happen. The genocide in Darfur is not just happening. What took place for years in the Nuba Mountains, it just didn't happen. These are flesh peddlers, world flesh peddlers, conspiring and peddling out their exploitative way of life, their nature, their goods. The proper thing is that the slaves conspire back. That's a conscious slave. That's a slave in revolt. Next, Maxwell sums up the dynamic of this slave insurrection in the colors of blue and green. Here's what he means.
I saw this big theme, as I said earlier, with blue and green. The green I use as a symbol of an essential feudal slaveocracy. And the blue, the capitalist orientation of Bermuda in the 18th century as a result of a maritime commercial revolution that was taking control of the country. What happened when these two things came together? When a feudal slaveocracy meets a maritime commercial revolution, the contradiction that is produced in this sense was the enslaved merchant mariner. As a consequence, the opportunity for this contradiction to make itself manifest was the conspiracy of 1761. We will thus examine three things to explain the context for this major revolt that ended all violent revolt in Bermuda. Number one, to meet the dramatic personage, the antagonist and the protagonist behind this, in connection with this revolt. And finally, to discuss the rise and fall of the conspiracy of 1761. Context.
All right, so Maxwell outlines how the green represents the feudal slaveocracy, which is basically the direct relationship within the slave master, the flesh peddler, and the slaves and the system that was developed within that, and then the overall government that developed in Bermuda as blue, as he describes it, symbolizing the ocean. The capitalist formation form, i.e. the maritime slave revolution, i.e. enslaved merchant mariners. In other words, slave sailors. What essentially happened was Bermuda transformed into a slave maritime society where you had incredible large numbers of slaves turned into sailors, who were then rented out. They weren't just on the plantation for their talent, for the services of the ship captains, who would pay the slaves, slavers, for the talent of the slaves. But in return, of course, the slaves got to see the world, and they start to understand the value of their particular labor and how it worked within this parasitic system in a global way. As they were going from coast to coast to Africa, Europe, North America, they saw the relationships that other black people found themselves in. They were they learned other languages, and they came to the conclusion that it was their talent that was important within this mechanism, and that they didn't need the slaver needed them to exploit them, which is how they made their enrichment. So the conclusion from the slaves, kill the slaver. the correct conclusion. But this highlights, which is why I'm pointing it out, the importance of getting around. You know, even in the, of course, modern day context, exploring your cities, exploring your towns, your surrounding cities, other states, if possible, other countries, if possible. If you were to go over the Bay Bridge from Oakland into San Francisco, you would be in another town, a city, just a bridge away. You follow 101, you would be in the South San Francisco, then Brisbane, San Bruno, San Mateo, Redwood City, Palo Alto. If you go east on University from Palo Alto, you go into East Palo Alto. If you go west, you go right into Stanford University. If you stay on 101, you soon, within an hour and a half, would be in the San Jose. In other words, one should explore all these different towns, these cities, relationships, get to know people within these different regions, find out how many police are in these particular cities, where are the police departments, where are the fire departments, how long it takes them to get to certain areas and stuff like that. These are all keys to understanding what needs to be understood as a slave in this world and beyond. Next, Maxwell describes how Bermuda developed into a maritime slaveocracy. Check this out.
1919, the arrival of the treasure, which brought a massive number of blacks, many of them kidnapped off of the Spanish American vessels. Bermuda was set up as an agricultural colony, and it employed its slaves toward that end. Unfortunately for it, however, it was unable to compete with the massive operations both in Barbados as well as Virginia. The result was that Bermuda's tobacco economy began to decline. It would eventually be replaced in much greater volume after 1684 with shipping. And from 1684 to the end of the 17th century, to what we call the maritime agricultural revolution, the maritime commercial revolution begins. It completely revolutionized Bermuda's economy and becomes the staple until around roughly when it too begins to decline from 1815 onwards. It has two major aspects. The first is shipbuilding, its production phase, if you like. And in particular, it produced what can only be called the Porsche of the Atlantic world. That is Bermuda's food. That is not Bermuda chauvinism, but it is recognized as being one of the fastest, at the time it was recognized as one of the fastest ships afloat. That was not only its factor, it was also able to sail in different directions, and as well as due to its design, and plus its construction out of Bermuda cedar, gave it protection from the worm. It became the staple in Bermuda's maritime commercial economy. The second was consumption, and that is the sale and commerce for sloops as well as other goods and the participation in the carrying trade. Bermudians became completely involved in and immersed in the transportation of goods throughout the Atlantic world. Bermudians also became involved in piracy and privateering, although most Bermudians would not admit that. At least as far as piracy is concerned. But privateering became one of its major involvements, and it was a perfect century in which to do it. Almost every single possible conflict was occurring, at least from 1700 to 1815. We had almost every major conflict, Queen Anne's War, the War of the Spanish Succession, the Seven Years' War, the North American Revolutionary War, the French Revolutionary War, and the War of 1812. Bermudians became immersed in basically what can only be called a parasitical economy in which the goods from this would then be resold throughout the Atlantic world.
So you can see what's taking place in the dynamics. And here in the slavers in Bermuda, they first had the slaves be basically tobacco farmers. But other slavers had a system that was already established and going pretty well, i.e. in Virginia and Barbados. So in Bermuda, it didn't take off. So did that stop the slavers from trying to stop from exploiting the slaves? No, they turned to maritime. My whole point is that, see, they're locked into a system of human exploitation because they're parasites. And it's their whole system of flesh peddling that produces and creates and looks for other avenues of exploitation. So when the tobacco farming slave system didn't take off, they turned to maritime shipbuilding, and that exploded. And one of the advantages is that other parasitic profit over human beings' economies were in conflict with each other. You know, the North American War, Seven-Year War, War of Spanish Secession, everything was blasting off and stuff. Similar to some of the conflicts that we see starting to ratchet up right now as these vulturistic societies, these profit market societies are bashing each other and maneuvering each other on the grand chessboard table for their own particular interests and stuff. So this development takes place, and it exposes that the dynamic and the relationship and that slaves will have with their slaver, which is why slaves have no obligation to the slaver or his system except to revolt against it. It is her and his real responsibility to destroy the slaver and the system. And it also helps highlight how don't allow yourself to be compartmentalized, as I was going into before about exploring different areas and so on and so forth. The slaves who were maritime slaves didn't allow themselves to be locked into a cell because of the situation that they were in. Now, because that is being a controlled, docilized, beat-down slave. Take someone like Stanley Tukey Williams, the former, the co-founder of the Crips. In many ways, he was locked mentally into a cell while he was physically on the streets in South Central, much more than he is now, while he's incarcerated in jail. Because his code on the streets at the time was the code of the streets, the code of the thug, the gangsterism, that whole thing, which is basically a trap, a trick, a death trap, with traps set up and designed by the slaver for you to fall through and end up in one of his dungeons. But once he started to explore the world through books and what have you, then his whole world view changed, and his whole code of ethic started to change. Now, as you know, here we have the code of the slave in revolt, and so that code is of course based in a code of individual and collective freedom, and understanding one's individual expression and individuality is tied to the collective freedom of the slaves. So there's a harmony against the atrocities and barbarity against the slave system, which is why in part I'm doing this like that, because many people ask me all the time, so what are you talking about with your code of the slave? Well, let's go into this aspect as we explore it through some of the experiences that our sisters and brothers were striving through in 1761. But next, check out here as Maxwell goes into the laws of control enforced on the slaves.
In entering to this, it's a maritime, it's a what I can only call the enslaved merchant sailor. But to understand that is to understand the context in which he was operating in. Bermuda had some of the strictest controls on slave provisioning in the Atlantic world. Among the strictest, several acts were passed in order to prevent slave provisioning on one side and slave mercantile activity on the other. As early as 1623, the so-called Act to Restrain the Insolencies of the Negroes prevented the self-provisioning by blacks, outlawed it completely, but it did allow for provisioning on behalf of one's owners. The Act to Prevent the Buying and Selling of and Bargaining with Slaves in 1690 also operated for the same purpose again. The purpose was to, this time, attack to prohibit the commerce the commercial activity by slaves. But it did did allow slaves to trade on behalf of their owners. Obviously, that gave an opportunity for a lot of abuse by slaves. It did, however, forbid independent servile farming. Slaves were not allowed to farm for the benefit of themselves, but for the benefit of their masters. However, slaves were able to get around that, and the statement by Mary Prince will give an idea of just how she did it. Mary Prince recalls, "I was for several years the slave of Mr. D." We think he's a Darrell. We don't, but we still keep him anonymous. "Here I worked on the ground, on his grounds. My work included planting and hoeing sweet potatoes, Indian corn, plantains and bananas, cabbages, pumpkins, onions, and so forth. I did all of his housework and attended to the horse and cow besides." This is completely opposite to her experiences in Antigua. And a quote will give this, will underscore this. Mary Prince of Antigua: "The way I made money was this. When my master and mistress went from home, as sometimes they did, they left me to take care of the house and premises. I had spent a good deal of time to spend by myself and made the most of it. I took in the washing, sold coffee and yams, and other provisions for captains of ships. I did not sit idle by during their absence of my owners, for I wanted by all honest means to earn money to buy my freedom. Sometimes I bought a hull cheap on board and sold it for double the money on shore. I also bought a great deal of by selling coffee. By this means, I acquired a little cash. Notice the difference in language. I own, purchase, mine. Completely different from I am working on behalf of somebody, and was constructed in this Peruvian society. Further acts. Act for the further and better regulation of Negroes and other slaves passed in 1730 was passed in the wake of a mass of poisoning plots. A huge series of restrictive legislation emerged for the purposes of controlling and regulating and better regulating servile behavior. It didn't, among these laws was the one I just mentioned, and it did have one particular purpose, and that was to outlaw the shipping out of goods. Already they recognized that slaves, regardless, were sending their goods overseas and selling and trading them. This was the outlaw. The argument was that the reason why this was happening that slaves were actually stealing goods and then selling their masters' goods overseas. So, if slaves were stealing the goods and selling their masters overseas, the idea was to get captains to stop it from happening. So captains were obliged to confiscate these goods when they saw them. Now remember, the idea was to encourage, was to prevent slaves from stealing, from taking goods stolen from somebody else and sending them overseas. So you would expect that the master would be a provision of the law that would require the master to return the goods back to the persons that they who sold them. There was no such provision. Masters did not return goods stolen. It's very akin to somebody stealing your watch. You begin to pick, somebody else picks up that watch and then keeps it without returning it to the person who originally owned it. Obviously, the law was not meant to return stolen goods. In fact, it was meant to crush the trade that was occurring at this time. And finally, in this series of acts, which will be extremely important in understanding the conspiracy of 1761, that is Act for the, and this is a very strange thing to term law, Act to Prevent the Exportation of Meat Cattle, Sheep, Hogs, and other poultry for all good except ducks, passed in 1761. This was meant to have an indirect effect on the trading of commerce. This notice of date, 1761. See, as already has happened, the Seven Years' War is in full bloom. As normally happens in wars, agricultural, particularly poultry and other such goods, are in high demand. Remember Mary Prince? Mary Prince said she sold that hog for double its worth. Obviously, slaves were in collusion with ship captains, putting these goods on the ship, selling them overseas, and making a profit unbeknownst to their masters. But the law was not meant to prevent that activity. The law was meant to keep all of the agricultural goods, except ducks, in the country, to prevent all of the sucking sound of agricultural goods going outside the country and going to other places while the unions were desperately needing them, and while slaves were profiting from it, among other people. So this was meant to crack down on that. So any slave, but particularly any slave found to be publicly whipped. The goods would then be confiscated. This, again, puts the statement into context. Remember the statement? If anybody took anything from me, I'll know the reason of it. In 1761, when this law is passed, this becomes a causal element, if you like, a precipitatory cause to the feeling of disquiet that made this particular revolution possible. But it's not the cause. Several factors were coming together to bring this revolution into fruition.
So as you can see, there's certain dynamics that are developing and layers of consciousness that are awakening, or I should say more synthesizing within the slaves about the particular situation one is in, and the dynamics of how the layers of laws are continuously being passed and stuff to regulate servile behavior, quote unquote. And in many ways, the pauperization that we see taking place of black people today is a form of trying to regulate servile behavior. Even the attack on black farmers, where the black farmers exposed how the federal government was in the forefront of crushing black farmers from their land. Now, it was proven in court, which really doesn't mean much because, well, it's within the confines of the slaver system. So even though the slaver was exposed, it's still all good because your strategy is more or less within the confines that the slaver finds acceptable because the slaver's writing the rules. But it just exposes the whole nature and dynamic of our people within this society and economies throughout the world that are based on this slave system. Now, you heard him talk about the sister who was just trying to make a little money and do a little thing for herself off of her own labor. In other words, she was just striving for various little forms of autonomy that slaves tried to do to try to make their living conditions more bearable. But it didn't stop them from developing their overall understanding of the situation that they were in. In other words, just getting a little bit of leeway every here and there, or being able to exploit some of the contradictions of the system, didn't stop them from understanding that the system overall is designed against them. So that's the conscious development of a slave in revolt. Also, the various laws that were designed directly, of course, to keep black people in place were how the laws were passed that slaves couldn't farm for themselves and slaves couldn't trade for themselves, but for their owners and stuff. So the whole dynamic is developing, and the contradictions are flowing. This, of course, in modern times, They'll let you trade certain goods and still keep it within the confines of their control, like drugs, because they know that that's the product of them. That's the product of poison conspired by them against us, as opposed to a product of poison conspired by us against them. So that's not a slave in revolt. That's just a Sambo in service of master and playing out master's deeds, the script that master is outlining, whether you are conscious of it or not. But next, let's go into how Maxwell explains how slaves exploited the contradictions of the slavers' interest and the government's overall perspective on things. So check this out.
Legislation in Bermuda made restrictive, a law made restrictive, put restrictive, put a restrictive regime on slaves to prevent them from treating slaves on their own behalf. But in practice, slaves took advantage of the lapses in law enforcement and the desire of the proprietors to profit from their work, as well as to not have to pay up for their own existence. So, if you knew that your slave was engaging in was engaging in trade, and you knew you didn't have to pay for it, let the slave do what he feels like. Ignore it. Put it as this. It was the lapse that slaves took advantage of. The problem, therefore, was not between slaveholders and slaves. It was between the government and everybody else, and slaveholders and their slaves. Of course, one can't leave the question of provision without leaving the question of expropriation of wages. As Bermuda became less agricultural and more artisan, a large number of slaves found themselves involved in artisan activity. This became the principal activity for slaves of Bermuda. The consequence, of course, meant that if you lent out your slave, you took the wages, and maybe then you could disperse whatever you could give out the proceeds of that if you were kind enough, or you could use it as a means of reward. This, to me, is the most essential aspect of this relationship. This is not a principally economic relationship. This is a very much akin to a feudal one, where politics, more than economics, determines the level of distribution. And in this case, feudal rent was how much was the wage that was turned over to the slaveholder. And the politics of relationship between slaves and slaveholders determined how much of that would be turned over back to the slave. Therefore, these relationships require looking at individual relationships between slaveholder and slave, than a general relationship between all slaveholders and all slaves. Some slaves were better at the politics than others, and some slaves were not very good at the politics than others. Some slaves had owners who didn't care about politics whatsoever, or had a punitive relationship. Some slaves did. But the capacity, the relationship, the dynamic between slaveholder and slave was the determining factor for how much was turned over to the slave. And how it was a check match, if you like, between slaveholders and slaves, where the goal of it was the acquisition of that feudal rent.
Now you can see the dynamics of what's taking place today getting more raw and ruthless, because as in the past where the slaver would rent out the slaves and the slaver would then decide, bargain, how much the slave would quote unquote be rewarded, there's no standard whatsoever, of course, because of the way the system is set up and how the slave is left of his and her own device and wit to, as Maxwell was talking about, bargain and maneuver and play a chess match with the slaver. Nowadays, you have corporate slavers who are moving us back within the system by crushing unions, slashing Davis-Bacon Act, drawing back on the minimum wage, creating free through free trade zones, quote unquote, deregulation of energy systems, pollution, control of the media, etc., etc. This is all part of the feudal slaver corporatocracy type model that these savages operate in. And we find ourselves going outside of their law quite naturally, as you hear on these airways, which is just another aspect of it, where understanding that their laws are designed as a mechanism of control. These laws are not designed to control them. They're there to allow them to flourish, and if the corporatocracy doesn't like a particular law, they'll just violate them, as they often do. So this is the dynamics of what was going on in the past, and how this mechanism in these slave systems still draws out the blood of the slave and exposes what's really going on in the world today. Now here, Maxwell describes how war and political events change dramatically the situation of the Bermudan slaves. So let's check this out.
As I said, a major revolution occurs within slave mercantile activity. Up to this point, up to the 18th century, it was entirely local when it happened. Then something happened in Britain that would have an effect on what would happen in Bermuda. The war, a major war of the Spanish Succession ends, and Britain obtains the Asiento of Spain. The South Sea Island, the South Sea, come to keep calling it the South Sea Island, the word island out of the South Sea. But the South Sea Company forms, Strasbourg's speculation brings it, causing the South Sea Company bubble to burst. And in the context of that, a large number of sailors, among other things, of all the economic deprivation, all the economic disasters, a large number of sailors are put out of work. This affects Bermuda. And a large number of white sailors become fertile ground for pirates. They immediately give themselves over to pirate crews, and the fear of this panics Bermuda. Bermuda is surrounded by a series of barrier reefs. You can't get into Bermuda unless you have the help of a pilot. It's even worse when you have, therefore as a result is we have a large number of ships thrown up on our reefs, perhaps over 300 of them. That's to give you an idea of how dangerous Bermuda's shore system is. So pilots were necessary. So the fear was that some of these pilots would be turned over to or join pirate crews and then be bringing all sorts of pirates in and out of Bermuda. So the governor at the time, a man by the name of Benjamin Bennett, decides that the only way to stop this is to try to change the numbers of the crews, to diminish the number of white men on these ships and expand the number of blacks. This increases the reach of Bermuda's mercantile activity. Up to this point, it's largely local. After this, it becomes very international. To give an idea, between 1708 and 1720, 28% of the crews that were on these boats, if you take the outward bound boats, 28% of these crews were black. In 1720, after the passage of the law, 34 of these crews are now black. By 1773 to 1774, Alain Forman Crane notices that 40% of all black men in Bermuda, 40% of all black men in Bermuda are recorded as sailors. There is a massive revolution within Bermuda's black mercantile activity. This gives them an expansive reach throughout the Atlantic world. And you can see by the list of ships where these sailors go, all of North America, all of the Caribbean, and as we're now beginning to realize, all of West Africa. Wherever the sloop went, they went. Wherever the sloop traded, they traded. And their trade was oftentimes done either without their masters knowing, or with some degree of collusion with ship captains. This was a perfect opportunity for goods to be closeted overseas and kept overseas and then brought back. And somebody said, oh, I wonder how that slave got so rich all of a sudden. This can be divided into tangibles and intangibles. The tangibles of the trade, to borrow a Redeker expression, was basically the trade throughout the Atlantic world, but also the prizes and the goods that came from that trade. Connections with black merchants throughout the Atlantic world was another aspect of what these enslaved merchant sailors did. And the profits, they would take the goods back and then resell them in Bermuda, normally to women who were there who would resell them in marketplace. To give an idea of just how many goods found their way to Bermuda, there was once a raid carried out on a ship for a woman, a slave woman named Beth, whose husband was a privateer. And this is what they found. Are you ready? One silver spoon, value of 10 shillings, current money, said Ireland. One silver spoon, a value of 1 shilling. A gold sleeve button, 12 shillings. Money, one red jacket petticoat, of white money. Silk jacket, a damask napkin, white holland shirts, stockings, apron, more calico. The volume, she had so many goods in her chest, the assumption was that she stole it. But no, as was pointed out in the trial, she did not steal it. It was gotten by virtue of her husband's activity. They said as a privateer, but it could have easily been as a participant in Bermuda's commercial activity. Which brings back to another problem. These goods were constantly in danger. There were constant complaints by merchants who said, by slave owners who said, I cannot understand how it is that I'm walking around in rags while that slave of mine is walking around in silk. Well, the reason why that slave of his, of course, it would never be the slave of his, it would be the slave of his neighbor. He wouldn't be complaining about his own slave, but the slave of his neighbor. The argument is that how did this happen? Because of the mercantile activity of these slaves. Of course, the goods could easily be confiscated, as perhaps the best. But the reality was, the art of it was to make sure you took the goods without the slave holder knowing about it.
So once again, the dynamic of these slaves was to eke out as best of a living under the condition that they were in, but at the same time understand and still plot for the destruction of the slaver. In other words, many of them got some of the basic necessities of life and were able to exploit the particular situation that they found themselves inhumanely in, but they didn't let that water down their consciousness. They were still plotting. In other words, they still followed a particular code of a slave where one should conspire, plot, and manipulate the situation for one's survival and the state's and system's destruction. So they kept their eyes on the prize, on what's real, true emancipation, not just certain little goods here and there and certain little comforts, you know, under an unbearable situation. These weren't sellouts. The dynamic that exploded the situation or helped explode the situation was through the Bermudians, white Bermudians, worrying about white raiders who were released from being sailors in other regions after the war. So they escalate the black males to be sailors, and it goes from 28% from 1718 to 1720 to over 40% of all black males in Bermuda by 1774 being recorded as sailors. And as I pointed out before, this helped develop the slaves' overall perspective as they became sailors and got to see around the world and the dynamics and how they interrelated within it. So next, let's move on to the aspect of Maxwell, who lines up the battle between the slaves and their major protagonist, Governor Popple, and the conspiracy of the slaves to use poison and blade, and the blade, against their slaver. So check this out.
Intelligent governor. The question was who was going to win, and it was not going to be decided very quickly. The slaves, and now the conspiracy itself. The slaves divided the conspiracy into two groups. One was the use of poison and the blade. On the one side, the idea was that slaves would use poison as a methodology to wipe out the whites, or the elite at the very least. The goal of it was to subvert and overthrow the country. So the idea was to put poison into slaves, put poison into food, but the utilization of poison, and we believe there's some evidence suggests that even the utilization of smallpox towards this end may be an aspect of the, what can only be called use of the weapons of mass destruction against slaveholders. But in this case, it almost, we do know that there was a definite use of poison and a definite use, there's a potential use of smallpox. The reason for smallpox was the complaint written in one of the documents saying that slaves were masquerading for cures as poison. If you're trying to cure somebody, but in reality, they're killing the person. That was the first plan. The second major use was the use of the French, what I like to call the French Connection. Remember, this is the Seven Years' War. The French and the British were in a do-or-die battle for control of the North, among other things, for control of North America. The French were willing to ally with anybody to bring down the British in North America. Of course. So, there is a good argument to suggest that French privateers were supposed to come to Bermuda. And then, upon their appearance, the slaves would rebel, pilots would go out and meet the French privateers, bring them into the country, and the French and the slaves would execute everybody on the island. It's a burden to the English. In fact, there was news that French privateers were floating around Bermuda in 1761. Another group left in March 1762. The slaves, in other words, were unifying the rebellion, bringing other people into this rebellion to overthrow the English. So Popple had a mind. News of this information was coming to Popple. Popple began to realize that on one hand, he slipped. The whole island would continue. The slaves, on the other hand, were needing the time. They were hoping that Popple, who they knew was the principal antagonist, would slip.
So you can see the dynamic that's taking place. The slaves were planning on using poison to wipe out at least the white elite, at the very least, with smallpox and poison in the food. In other words, they weren't playing around. They knew this was a life or death struggle. And when you're a slave, you don't... If you're not resisting against the slaver, you don't have your destiny in your own hand. It's in the hands of the flesh peddler. So you best do what's necessary. Which is why now, in modern times, one needs to learn about chemistry, biology, medicines, herbs, all of these various things that are useful tools against the slaver in this current slave system. Now, it's interesting also how Maxwell goes into how basically the slaves in Bermuda were using the French, because they knew that the French were in a battle with the British. They were going to ally themselves with the French. The French had ships waiting outside, it appears, and they were just going to execute everyone on the island. Now, this is similar to how the Haitian slaves saw the dynamics between the British and French, aligned themselves with the French to help defeat the British in Haiti, and then turned on the French. Used the British to help crush the French, and then turned on the British for their overall emancipation. In other words, they had no illusion about the fact that both of them were slavers and wanted to exploit their flesh, to exploit their blood, the blood of the slave, because they're the gods of exploitation, and they're that's where they're coming from. That's where their God, that's what their God is all about. Their God is exploitation, money, torture, etc., war. But the Haitians wisely use this dynamic in a similar way that black people had no illusion about the savages in the North, in the Americas during the North-South conflict. But they knew that the best way to crush the South would be to align themselves with the North, which is why 200,000 plus strong black soldiers joined the North to crush the South. Now, of course, in a better overall situation, we could have then just turned on the North and crushed both of them. But we weren't physically in that particular situation. But it's understanding the relationship one is in. Because as I said, the slave owes the slavers nothing. So one should always be conspiring and plotting out. Because our obligation as slaves is to ourselves, is to raise our own consciousness and other slaves in collaboration for revolt against the slaver and the system. Now, next, Maxwell goes into the chess match between Popple, who is trying to crush the rebellion, and the slave.
This brings us to the reaction against the rebellion. Popple realizes he's in the middle of a chess match, and now it's time to see what he's going to do. But he faces two problems. The problem was number one, slave owners. And the problem for number two, the conspirators. The problem for the slave owners is that they didn't like him, but they trusted him. And the slave owners had this particular view that, remember, it's a very feudal relationship. As far as they were concerned, slaves were obedient to them, the slave owners, but they had no responsibility at all to the island as a whole. So it didn't matter. They were looking at it purely in selfish terms. Remove my slave, and I'll be inconvenienced. And not too concerned that whether or not there's, and the slave, using the politics of relationships, be able to convince the slave owner that I'm not involved in anything at all, master. I am being obedient to you. That was the clever manipulation of the slave owner. Popple knew the game. So he had to find a way of getting the slave owners to cooperate with the reaction. But he also had to get the slaves to cooperate. So he issued a tripartite scheme. Number one, free Negro informants were given £25 bounty, and slaves were given, informed were given freedom, and the guilty, if you find that you're guilty, you'll be given amnesty. Well, not for that, but worked. Because the one thing you could offer to slaves is the potential for freedom, slaves always jump for it. If it worked, it failed. It was a massive failure. The omerta that the slave extended over the other population was so intense that Popple could complain that we can get no information at all to convict only any more than six people. So they frustrated his ability to get informants. then came the proprietors. The proprietors, of course, at this particular point, what Popple was doing was ordering the arrest and arrest of slaves island-wide. This was causing disquiet. If you can imagine, all of a sudden someone's knocking on the door and three or four slaves are leaving. This was causing conflict, as Popple feared would. Many of them didn't trust the governor enough not to use his power to abuse them. And in fact, they became particularly horrified when the governor laid down martial law. This gave the governor life or death control over all of the men who were in fact part of the militia. Now, keeping in mind, this is a governor who is unpopular and suddenly had life or death power over them. Secondly, it gave them no control at all, as the operation was, in terms of determining whether the slaves were guilty or innocent. There was a potential welling up of a conflict between Popple and the slaveholders.
So you can see the dynamic that's being played out and how it had evolved, where you had basically the slaveholders for their own individual selfish means didn't want anything that would restrict their short-term and long-term extreme profitability. It's similar to how the corporation's mentality is, where anything that they even see as a short-term hindrance on their profit-making schemes, they'll frown at, even if the state overall is trying to protect their overall interest and stuff, because they're so locked in a narrow, super exploitative mindset that anything that even in the short term may possibly set back some of their particular profits, even though overall it's protecting their particular slave interests, they frown upon. So many people who are worrying about the way that the petroleum industry is plunging the world into chaos. Of course, they're not against the profit-making mechanisms of the petroleum industry and so on and so forth, but they do want to at least put some restraints and some regulations so that the earth doesn't turn upside down. But of course, many in the petroleum industry just frown upon that, because be damned if even anything in their short-term profit scheme is hindered somewhat. Well, this is how the slavers were acting towards Popple, the governor, even though he's trying to protect their interests because the slaves are plotting to overthrow the whole system itself. Now, the slaves were smart because they were playing it cool. You know, they're acting like everything's a-okay, master. You know, I'm obedient to you. Yeah, which is why there's nothing wrong with plotting within the system. You know, getting security I'm not talking about being, you know, some jobs where you're running around bounty hunting black people or something like that. But having some security guard-like jobs to navigate your way within the system, within sales, with the goal of penetrating some of the enemy's forces and finding out what needs to be found out, and, you know, use your imagination. But this is the dynamic that the slaves found themselves in. Now, what's interesting, though, is that this also goes to the aspect that the black slaves of that time, on an individual level, who were owned by the masters, had a direct material value as slaves themselves in the work that they produced for the flesh peddlers. Now many black people have been pauperized, and where our unemployment
is how many of the modern day flesh peddlers make their profit off of us through creating various laws, drug laws, gun control laws, crime laws, you know, war on crime, war on guns, war on drugs, because their prison industrial complex is a money-making scheme for these parasites, the privatized prison industrial complex, and those who work within the system, you know, prosecutors, who, you know, et cetera, et cetera, others who become judges and legislators, you know, from prosecuting, you know, the urban black masses, Latinos, et cetera, et cetera. This is how the parasitic nature works. And highlights the dynamics of the whole parasitic scheme of things. And some of the things that we need to do to plot against it. It doesn't mean it's stagnant like that, but it just shows the whole parasitic nature of this brutal, savage system. Now, here next, Governor Popple then brings in the flesh peddlers, the slavers, into the decision-making apparatus so that they'll be a part of the anti-liberation machine directly. So let's see how this plays itself out.
Popple decides to back in. He basically offers slaveholders an opportunity to sit on the Council of Judgment. What was commissioner, I think was called the Commissioner of War. And their purpose was guilty slaves will be brought before this commission, and this commission will be determined whether or not they're guilty or innocent. This gave them an opportunity to be involved in the management of the reaction, so that their own interests would not be sacrificed, and therefore bring them in to the reaction against slaves, and remove from the slaves a tool for their political resistance. Secondly, slaveholders were also given an opportunity, because Popple either was to get them out of the country, either by killing them or by expelling them, that slaveholders would be given the opportunity to, once slaves were determined that they may or may not be involved, they would be on their own initiative allowed to put the slaves into goods and sell them overseas. This meant, again, put the slaveholders in a position where they weren't losing money from the loss of their slaves. Also, as we'll find out in the reaction, slaveholders, a generous compensation scheme came for those who were found guilty. Sometimes, well, nearly double the value of the slave himself or herself. Then all of a sudden, good news. Popple found out, was given information that a man by the name of Jack Hare had information about the conspiracy, that he himself was probably involved in it. So he was secreted away somewhere in North America in order that he would be able to be brought back and to be able to find out more people who were responsible. He then disappears. He never makes it back to Bermuda until way after the trials. As Popple says, as the legislators complain, made to disappear by some evil-minded persons. So much for that informant.
So Popple outlines his next strategy, which was to bring the slavers into the decision-making apparatus, which is something that we see now, where we often see lobbyists and consultants for corporations being brought to the table within the slave system on decision about environmental regulation, genetic engineering into food and stuff like that. So they end up being part of the decision-making board for within the process, showing how corroded and corrupt the system is, and showing how it's still within a slave system. It's just modernized. So the slaves found themselves in a situation where now, since the slavers were going to be monetarily rewarded if they found a slave to be involved and they were to ship them off or execute them. Now the slavers were more willing participants in this whole process. So once again, this helps show how the laws and things that are constructed within this society are the laws of the slaver society. They can be constructed and removed at will for the, and it's all within the confines and benefits of the slaver. This these laws are designed to keep us enslaved, so we should have no obligation to these social, political, intellectual chain gang apparatus tools and mechanisms within the society. Now, the reason why I bring that this up is that you know, you often hear people talk about like issues of gun control, and is and argue back and forth about gun control being a way of safety for the you know, for the society. And they often use black people as an example of making the inner city safe and all of that. But gun control laws or non-gun control laws, the history of the slave has always been someone who is manipulated by laws. Now, you often hear people talk about, you know, the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms and stuff like that. I'm going to read a little bit from a guy named Carl T. Bogus. And it goes into the hidden history of the Second Amendment, to go into how some of the constructs of these things are really developed, and not to look at it from his perspective overall, but the slave's perspective. But first, let's go into a little bit of his article, or written historical piece. It goes like this, quote, "Slavery was not only an economic and industrial system," one scholar noted, "but more than that, it was a gigantic police system," quote unquote. Over time, the South had developed an elaborate system of slave control. The basic instrument of control was the slave patrols, armed groups of white men who made regular rounds. The patrols were made sure that blacks were not wandering where they did not belong, gathering in groups, or engaging in other suspicious activities. Equally important, however, was the demonstration of constant vigilance and armed force. The basic strategy was to ensure and impress upon the slaves that whites were armed and watchful and ready to respond to insurrectionist activity at all times. The state required white men and female plantation owners to participate in the patrols and to provide their own arms and equipment, although the rich were permitted to send white servants to their place. Virginia, South Carolina, and Georgia all had regulated slave patrols. By the mid-18th century, the patrols had become the responsibility of the militia. Georgia statutes enacted in 1755 and 1757, for example, carefully divided militia districts into discrete patrols areas and specified when patrols would muster. The Georgia statutes required patrols under the direction of the commissioned militia officers to examine every plantation each month and authorize them to search, quote, all Negro houses for offensive weapons and ammunition, unquote, and to apprehend and give 20 lashes to any slave found outside plantation grounds. In the South, therefore, the patrols and the militia were largely synonymous. The Stono Rebellion had been quickly suppressed because the white men worshiping at the Willtown Presbyterian Church on that Sunday morning had, as required by law, gone to church armed. Some of the accounts of the Stono referred to the body of white men who attacked the black insurrectionists as the militia, quote-unquote, while others referred to them as planters, quote-unquote. This is a distinction without a difference. The two groups were one and the same, virtually All able-bodied white men were part of the militia, which primarily meant that they had slave control duties under the direction and discipline of the local militia officers. The militia was the first and last protection from the omnipresent threat of slave insurrections or vengeance. The war for independence had placed the South in a precarious position. Sending the militia to the war against the British would leave Southern communities vulnerable to slave insurrections. The Southern states, therefore, often refused to commit their militia to the Revolution, reserving them instead for slave control. Nor could the South help by sending much in the way of arms, for rifles were in short supply and necessary to defend against possible slave insurrections. After the war, the militia remained the principal means of protecting the social order and preserving white control over an enormous black population. Anything that might have weakened this system presented the gravest of threats. The South's fear that the North might destabilize the slave system, weakening white control over the slave populations, gave anti-federalists a powerful weapon, unquote. Now that's just a little piece of his whole thing that goes into how the Second Amendment was actually written and influenced as a means of controlling the slave population. So the laws that have been written and created then and today still serve a similar purpose. Now, the reason why I mention this is that even when you hear people talk about gun control laws, they're saying it within a narrow scope. Because first of all, look, while it's easy to get guns on the streets of Oakland, it's even easier to get drugs on the streets of Oakland, even though there are more stricter drug control laws than there are gun control laws. There's an absolute prohibition on drugs like cocaine and heroin, even though they're more readily available than guns. So what makes one think that if they put in more stringent gun control laws, that that would restrict the availability of guns any more than it does drugs? No, what it would do is allow the slave patrollers, the police, and other apparatus to then wage intensified forms of war in the name of guns, like they do in the name of drugs, in the name of crime, in the name of illegal immigration on their desired slave populations. So the war on drugs, which is really a war on black, and a war on crime, war on black, and a war on guns, Amadou Diallo. Let's not forget, Amadou Diallo was killed by some war on gun cops. These cops in New York under Giuliani were supposed to be quote unquote getting guns off the streets, i.e. a war on guns. But of course they turned it into their white slave patrol insurrectionist operation, slave patrolling tool, which basically meant getting black people out of existence, with their own personal model of we control the night. So they went from getting guns off the streets to we control the night, which basically meant if we catch you on the streets at night, Negroes, we will kill you, which is exactly what happened to 41 Bullets Amadou Diallo, where they sprayed at him with 41 bullets, hitting him 19 times, all in the name of fighting guns, even though all he had in his hand were, you know, a wallet or, you know, a pair of keys. But this is how the apparatus works. But the laws, you know, Bogus and all of these guys, historians and professors, they'll go back and forth talking about what the constructors of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution meant. But from the eyes of the slave, all of that is irrelevant because the laws are designed for our control in the first place. Regardless of their intention, we know how these things play themselves out and the true meaning behind the state towards us. So when one takes, for example, the situation and plight of Geronimo DiGiorgio, the former Panther out of L.A., who was framed up by the FBI and the police and sent to prison for 27 years for a crime he didn't commit. He was finally released and they gave him $4.5 million after they destroyed 27 years of his best life. But what's fascinating about this is that one of the Sambos that helped incarcerate Geronimo was a punk by the name of Julius Butler. Now, Julius Butler was a known criminal. He had a criminal record. He was a he had a felony, and under California state law, if you have a felony, you can't own and possess a handgun. But since Julius Butler was on their side, i.e. the side of the state, a criminal on the side of the criminal state, the state not only, meaning the police and FBI, not only knowingly allowed him to have a handgun, but they gave him the money to purchase one. Which all exposes the fact that this is not about, their laws are not about safety or anything or like that. It's about whose side are you on. And they'll use their laws as a tool to attack, destroy, and control us, while they'll ignore and violate the laws for themselves or for those people who align themselves with them, like Julius Butler. The modern day slave patrollers in New Orleans were the ones with the guns and the badges on the Gretna overpass that were shooting over the heads of black people and people who were with black people trying to cross over the overpass from New Orleans into dry land, into safety, to a place where there was food and shelter. But the slave patrollers were guarding that area and didn't allow that to happen. Now, even though this is a vast violation of human rights and dignity, it doesn't matter to a lawless, barbaric society and state, nor do the laws or concepts of common decency, because they're about social political order for the order. So at the end of the day, their particular laws, as I was saying before, which are designed to keep us enslaved, who cares what's scribbled down in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or whatever? A slave, a true slave, doesn't go by those outlines, because one understands that they are just instruments for our destruction. Now next, let's go into the penetrating effect that these slave courts, like the laws, in this slave system had against our slave sisters and brothers during the insurrection of 1761. Check it out.
The result was in three forms. One was execution. Only six could be executed according to law. And this was significant. Not only executed, included among those were those who made positive statements about their involvement, even though I have reason to believe they may not have been involved. Nat, for example, who simply said that it will be his wife's frolic in it, he was executed. The idea was quite simple. We're not quite too concerned whether you're guilty or innocent. We need something dramatic in order to convince the slaves that this is not the way to go. And you just happen to have evidence against you that can be used as Paul puts it, according to law. Whether he was actually guilty or innocent is still an open question. But it didn't matter. And unfortunately, only six fall in that category. They were executed, and their bodies were taken, particularly one of them who was judged to be the ringleader, his body was taken to Warwick where he was hanged, and his body was burned. The second were expulsions, which was the most dramatic method that he had, that Popper used. It was dramatic because of the action. For the first time, Bermuda's black population actually does not increase. Between 1762 and 1764, the adult male population actually declines, which gives an indication just how widespread. This was the most effective tool he used to crush the rebellion. He got them out of the country with the help of slaveholders, who also were merchant mariners. So concerned with other countries that Bahamas had to pass a law to prevent conspirators from being sent to the Bahamas. Because they figured out they knew what Bermudians were going to do. Oh, I see. They're going to send us your conspirators and then have us pay for it.
So they were sent to North America instead. The second were punishments. among those people who were exiled was Charles Cox, whose mother likely was probably involved, and Peter and Tom Cooper, who were not. Charles Cox was condemned to eternal exile. But keeping in mind, remember, that merchant mariners need that external relationship in order to make a profit. By cutting him off from the external relationship, but utilizing his skills in Bermuda as a pilot, which actually benefits the slaveholder, because he's still bringing goods and services in for the slaveholder, the result was there was an effective punishment against for his involvement. The result of that was, the reason for it was because his slaveholder, the person who owned him, begged that they not send him overseas. The governor and council probably realized that since he was probably a conspirator, they had to send him overseas. There was no evidence against, but they had to send him overseas anyway. To meet her demand and their cooperation, he was condemned to eternal exile. Peter was not expelled, and neither was Tom Cooper. In fact, Tom Cooper would eventually become free when William Cooper, his master and mistress, died.
So you can see what they did with their slave courts, slave system, and their slave laws. Now, it's interesting how Nat was executed. And it wasn't even real clear if he was quote-unquote guilty or innocent. And this is what they commented upon. But they figured they need to set an example to convince the slaves this is not the way to go. Now, if I had time, I would do my commentary, White Justice, Black Misery, the legal and illegal lynching of a people, after this, because it goes into the aspect that the legal and illegal lynching of black people within America was designed as a collective guilt strategy to terrify the black masses. One's innocence was not really the primary target and interest. It was conditioning the black masses to know their place under the hooves of white supremacist oppression. So the concept of more or less find a Negro, any Negro, lynch a Negro, and display as gruesomely as possible the results of this massacre, you know, crushing their body parts after you burnt them up into little pieces, putting them in little jars, selling them at the dime stores, making postcards out of them, etc., etc., was a way of traumatizing the population. So that even if you quote-unquote didn't get the right one, even if there was a quote-unquote right one, you would get the desired psychological effect. And the other aspect was the expulsion out of Bermuda, which in modern days, so you saw a decrease of the male slave population in Bermuda during this period. The modern day of expulsion is more or less the prison system, especially for political, direct political prisoners, but all of it is political. And so was the form of spatial deconcentration within the urban black masses and stuff. It's a way of expulsing, imploding the population to decrease its effectiveness against the slaver and tossing it out into a form of internal and external exile. Now here, Maxwell outlines new legislation that was then constructed against the slave. Check this out.
But what was most significant finally in this was the new legislation that was passed. In every conspiratorial event in Bermuda, legislation got passed in order to control the better code regulation of the slaves. This happened in 1656, and it happened again in 1730. The target of this new legislation in 1761 were the free blacks. Free blacks were accused of running taverns, buying slaves, secreting goods, and providing a bad example all around. So the idea was, as Bermuda had gotten to the practice of doing, rounding up its free blacks putting them on a boat and sending them overseas. Pablo agreed with the dedication of the three blacks, and then in a fire that is to the house of the Walter Craig Plantation said, you know, these people are, they're good from here to there. They're doing something irregular. You cannot decide people for their freedom. There are three people in Thailand, and number one, there are fanatics to stop it. So we cannot expel them and suggest that the law get crushed. Someone asked me earlier, had governors crushed laws? This is one that they did. And he said, and among other things, there was no suspending clause. In other words, the clause was normally a suspending clause would wait until the king had actually given his assent and then put it into action. If there was no suspending clause, they would have left in action immediately. Papa said, no, there is no, the law is to be canceled and the law is. That meant from 1761 onwards, Bermuda beginning to have a more recognized population of free blacks. It happened before, but for this time, they were now to be covered by law. And every law from that point forward has always begins with, when you regulate blacks, doesn't just regulate Negroes with the assumption of being slaves, but there are now three Negroes, three blacks, three colors, three mulattoes, etc. They now make, but the old law says, Negroes, mulattoes, and Indians, bond and free. Bond and free becomes a term from 1761, recognizing that now we have to deal with the free population in Bermuda. Bermuda, for the longest while, has the smallest free black population in the Caribbean and in North America. This new act, by the way, was called the Act for the Better Government of Negroes, Mulattoes, and Indians, Bond and Free, and for the more effectual punishment of conspirators.
So what this helps outline is that the legislation by the state structure, the state apparatus, the state machine, which is an entity of violence, treachery, repression, and control. Their laws are for the control and maintenance of the system. Their legislation is designed to control us. It's not about freedom. It's about the stability of the slave system. So the crime against the slaves being inflicted upon them by the slavers is not an issue for the flesh peddlers. They know that the slaves are captives of their war. But within their war machine, they're out to design mechanisms to make sure that the slaves stay captives of their perpetual war. So they expand it out for more social, political, psychological control. So here, let's wrap this up as Maxwell goes into what happened to the sister, Rachel Farber, who we started this whole situation up with, who had her two kids stolen. And even though she was a free woman, let's see how the slave system dealt with her when all the smoke from the burning flesh of the slave was somewhat clear.
Remember Rachel Farber? Rachel Farber had been put on ice for a period of time. Still, she still didn't have her children, and she still was free. So as 1763 arrives, she resubmits her petition, but she makes a couple of changes. Change number one is she sues every female, by the way, that died, and his wife is now in possession of her children. So she proceeds to, number one, sue the wife for £500 current money. That is a lot of money. And soon, she places on her a whip of captives, basically demanding that she compel a prisoner to do. Now, look what this means. The three black women, all of these prisoners, of a white nation. Well, obviously now things have changed. The environment is toppled by the virus for the first time, but sick and on his way back to England. He has no real role in this. In fact, he has no more power over anything at this point. By 1764, he's on a boat, and by 1764, he's dead. So by the time he gets to the movie, he's out of the picture. The Court of Advisors side refuses to rule on it at all. It sends it to the council, government, and sends to the council. This time, the council is run by the meeting by the name of Francis Jones. He doesn't have the meeting at all anywhere near the government, by the explosion. He has the meeting at his house, in Paris, and says that what she wants went beyond the original list, and that it was a dangerous precedent to have a free black woman enslaving a white person. So they sent it to the assembly, which was the last thing they needed to send, and every single one of them said that, number one, that this writ was dangerous, and it would portend dangerous consequences, and number two, that it was followed by a way of being free. She is in fact a slave, and she should be turned over to Mrs. Seymour to serve out her slave. In other words, completely nullifying her freedom, completely nullifying the manuscript signed by the government. It was not really a rebuke against gubernatorial authority, but also not only the rebuke against freedom, but also about gubernatorial authority as well. And the government was no way to be seen at this particular point, given its great action. Therefore, the legacy. Bonding would now live under a more restrictive system that wouldn't change until 1828 and finally 1834 when they were free. Feudalism would reassert itself in its stricter form. And as for Rachel Hubbard, she lost what she called the most blessing, most valuable blessing on earth.
So here this sister, who after having her two kids kidnapped by the flesh peddler, has her quote-unquote day in court, and they say that her writ is dangerous, and they didn't, and it could set a dangerous precedent. A free black woman ordering the imprisonment of a slaver woman who now was in possession of the two kids. So they negate her freedom and enslave her along with the two kids that were enslaved, outlining the fact and recycling the fact that the mindset in connection of these slavers and their slaver system overlaps region to region. This basically aligns itself and overlaps with the Dred Scott decision, where in the Dred Scott decision, the courts ruled that there's no law concerning a black man that a white is bound to respect. Well, here they're saying that there's no law concerning a black woman that their courts are bound to respect. So they ignore the laws and her particular rights and enslave her because of the precedent that they did not want it to represent. So her blackness and their whiteness overrides the laws because they know that the laws are designed for white control over black. So once again, this is why I say there's no law that the slave is bound to respect of the slaver. We just see this as techniques, litigation and strategies for our overall control. And we know that the slaver has no respect for the laws themselves, except to use these laws when convenient for our control, gun control, drug control laws, or ignore them when they are inconvenient and they want to use them to pulverize us. New Orleans internally displaced persons. These are international laws that Sam is quote-unquote supposed to be abiding by, but Sam is an international criminal, so all spectrums of the order you see in New Orleans ignoring the internally displaced laws of the people of New Orleans and marching straight ahead with their particular agenda, the Old Line family, the corporations, the developers, the real estate agents, the police, the mercenaries, etc. So why should the laws of the state be something revered by the slave when we know these are tools and instruments of our own destruction? And the dynamics of their wars, which are produced by the state, is a means to further enslave populations and their resources for the rulers of the particular society's personal enrichment. Which is why a slave should understand that we're under constant siege of war until the slavers and their market profit systems are but a bad memory in world history. The sisters and brothers who plotted and strived for their emancipation in Bermuda by any and all means through the blade and poison are people who strove through in a tradition that should be applauded and emulated in various ways in this country and throughout the world. Because those slaves understood the situation that they were in and understood that their emancipation is not to be realized within the system of the flesh peddlers, but through the death of the flesh peddlers and their system. Because death and destruction and exploitation for the flesh peddlers of the world is not only a tradition, but a way of life. A life that we have to exterminate for the slave's survival. Until the next time, and in tradition of our sisters and brothers in 1761 who gave a noble try for true freedom in Bermuda. Slave out.